Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Hey.
Welcome to Learning English on The Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, Ana Mateo brings us words and their stories. And we'll hear more about American history on our series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here's Dan Friedel with our education report.
Even before the COVID-19 health crisis, many American colleges and universities started to reconsider the value of tests like the SAT and ACT. Standardized tests have been criticized for many years. Some education experts argue that they only show how well a student takes tests instead of how much they have learned. International students and students who did not grow up speaking English have struggled with these tests in the past. Because of this, some universities ended their test requirement. Research from the company that creates one of these tests, ACT Incorporated, shows that the number of test optional schools increased by 200 to over 900 from 2014 to 2019. But when large group activities, such as testing events for students, were canceled in 2020, even more colleges became test optional. This means they do not require, but will still accept, standardized test scores in students' applications. As a result, many colleges that are known to be highly selective in their admissions policies received more applicants than usual. A recent story in the Washington Post newspaper said the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, known as MIT, had 66% more applicants in 2021 than it did in 2020. The University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA, received 28% more. The research by ACT Incorporated showed that many schools will continue their test optional policy after the coronavirus health crisis ends. Eric Hoover writes about college admissions for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He said colleges will continue to consider test scores, but test optional policies should help students who struggle with tests.
If you're someone who doesn't love taking tests and you feel like tests are not the best representation of who you are as a student and what your potential is, then I think it's fair to say that the world's getting a little kinder and gentler for the many, many great students who, for whatever reason, just don't fare as well on the ACT or the SAT, those kind of standardized tests.
Earlier this year, VOA spoke with Kittist Bekele, a student from Annandale High School in Northern Virginia. She was born in Eritrea and only recently came to the U.S. VOA spoke to her again to ask about test optional applications. Bekele said she had taken the SAT before the pandemic and was not happy with her score of 1,120 out of a possible 1,600. she was planning to take the test again, but it was canceled. She was glad that colleges considered her whole record and did not disqualify her because her score was lower than she hoped.
I know a lot of people that are really good with school, have a good GPA, but still don't do good on ACTs. I think it's all about using your time and like test-taking skills.
She was accepted to a number of universities and is currently considering George Washington University in Washington, D.C., Virginia Commonwealth University, and Virginia Tech. All three schools were test optional, and she did not send her score. Bekele said she moved out of English as a second language classes 2 years ago, but she still had trouble with some of the reading parts of the tests. The writing was easier than the reading, but the reading was very hard, she said. For people like me, it's not a good representation of what people do in school. Hoover, the education writer, noted that universities use test scores for reasons other than deciding who gets in. They use them as a way to find out which students to recruit and as a way to decide to whom they might offer financial aid. Bekele said she understands test optional schools may still use test scores to make a choice between one student who submitted a score and one who did not. They might choose that student even though it was a test optional school. It would definitely be recognized, she said. Zoe Coyle is from Cleveland, Ohio. She will start her first year at Tufts University in Boston, Massachusetts in the autumn. Tufts was test optional, but she still sent her scores. Her high school's advisor told students to do that. If we didn't, she said, then it would be telling the school that we were below average. She said test optional admissions give students who are outstanding at something other than academics the confidence to send applications. She spoke about her friends who wanted to study music and theater in college. They chose not to send their scores. Coyle said she sees how test scores can help colleges choose students, but she is pleased that they are making scores less important.
It does feel like notes from teachers and personal essays are way more important, and it kind of feels like colleges are leaning into that more. And for some colleges, COVID kind of gave them the opportunity to take much bigger steps in that direction, which I guess is one of the few benefits of COVID.
ACT Incorporated said about 30% more schools put a test optional policy in place in 2020. Whether they continue that policy may depend on how the current group of college students perform. I'm Dan Friedel.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in American English. Today, you might want to roll up your sleeves. We are going to get our hands dirty. Figuratively, that is. Playing in mud is a popular activity for many children all around the world. What child doesn't love mixing just the right amount of water and dirt to get the perfect mud? If you want to go farther, you can make mud pies. Shape the mud into circles and then decorate them with little sticks and stones, flowers and leaves, basically any small item you can find on the ground. Or perhaps making mud pies is not your thing. Maybe just digging in the mud is more your speed, or to your liking. The feel of mud in your hands can be good for adults, too. In fact, many people pay a lot of money for face and body mud treatments. Maybe that is one reason people like to garden or make things from clay. You must get your hands dirty. And that is our expression for today. Getting your hands dirty is a useful expression, and it has two very different uses. The first one is for honest, hard-working people. If I am willing to get my hands dirty, it means I am willing to do the hard work of a project myself. I do not give the dirty work to others. Now that hard work could deal with actual dirt, or it could just mean the hard parts of a project. It just means that you are willing to roll up your sleeves and do whatever hard work is needed to finish a job. For example, let's say my good friend is running for mayor. There is a lot of hard work needed to win an election. So I help gather signatures to get her on the election ballot. I walk around neighborhoods and pass out information to hundreds of voters. She does too. She is not afraid to get her hands dirty, and neither is her team of volunteers. When she wins, she thanks us all for our hard work. Okay, now it is 4 years later. My friend has been in office and has become very powerful. In fact, you could say that power has gone to her head. She is not thinking clearly or legally when she asks me to do her a favor. That brings us to the other way we use the expression, get your hands dirty. This way is for dishonest people. Let's imagine that my friend, the mayor, calls me into her office and asks me to do something for her. Something illegal. She wants me to ask a building developer for money for her re-election campaign. In return, she will give him some city business. She promises me that nothing will happen, but she simply can't risk getting her hands dirty. I tell her that I really can't risk going to jail. I also tell her that we are no longer friends. And that is the end of this Words in Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov. Thank you.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of George W. Bush. Bush began his second term and fifth year in office in January 2005. Early in his first term, terrorists had carried out the worst attacks in United States history. President Bush declared a war on terror and led the country into wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In his second inaugural address, he promised to continue fighting to defeat terrorism and increase democracy around the world.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
He also talked about his goals at home and what he called America's ideal of freedom.
In America's ideal of freedom, citizens find the dignity and security of economic independence instead of laboring on the edge of subsistence. This is the broader definition of liberty that motivated the Homestead Act, the Social Security Act, and the GI Bill of Rights. We will widen the ownership of homes and businesses, retirement savings, and health insurance, preparing our people for the challenges of life in a free society. By making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny, we will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear and make our society more prosperous and just and equal.
The United States Constitution limits presidents to two terms. Presidential historian Russell Riley at the University of Virginia's Miller Center says presidents traditionally use their first term to focus on their major goals for the country. Second terms, he says, tend to be unhappy times. During his second term, Richard Nixon resigned over the attempt to hide political wrongdoing in the Watergate case. Bill Clinton faced a trial in the Senate over his attempt to hide a relationship with a young aide. But the first major problem of George Bush's second term dropped from the sky.
You saw people on the rooftops. You saw people using claw hammers trying to break through their attic to get up onto the roof. That's why you had so many people who drowned.
In August of 2005, Susan Bennett received a phone call from her daughter, a television reporter in New Orleans, Louisiana.
She called on a Friday and said, "I think you need to come and pick up my son because there's a really big storm coming."
It was Hurricane Katrina, one of the worst natural disasters in American history. Along the Gulf of Mexico, the hardest hit states were Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Over 1,800 people died. Property damage totaled more than $75 billion. But Katrina will be remembered mostly because of what happened in New Orleans.
They just gutted the hotel!
A day before the storm hit, officials had ordered everyone to leave the city. But thousands of people stayed. Some chose not to leave. Others were too poor, too old, or too sick to go. Then the levees broke. Those flood barriers were supposed to protect the city. Much of New Orleans was built on land that lies below sea level. As Katrina hit, more than 80% of the city flooded. In some areas, the water was 6 meters deep. Many people who stayed were caught in the floods. Officials struggled to get food, water, and medicine to the survivors. The displaced included thousands of people who took shelter in the Superdome, a big sports arena. Out on the streets, lawless acts fed a sense of disorder and helplessness.
It's disgusting and frustrating, and we are human beings, and they're treating us like we're criminals.
Susan Bennett helped create an exhibit about Hurricane Katrina at the Newseum, a museum of news in Washington.
Not only in this country, but also in newspapers across the world, you saw the same headline. It ranged from engulfed to our tsunami, chaos, and then it went to anarchy, national disgrace.
Congress later found that officials at every level of government, local, state, and federal, had failed in doing their jobs. President Bush flew over New Orleans to inspect the damage. A photograph showed him looking out the window of Air Force One at the ground below. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says the picture expressed what many people were thinking about the handling of the disaster.
Because of the ineffectiveness of the government response at the time, that image communicated to the American people that the president was remote, that he wasn't on the ground, that the best he could do was just look out the window of a passing plane.
In 2005, a different kind of storm was hitting Iraq. American and Iraqi officials were struggling to create a democratic government. Local militias were on the rise and attacking coalition forces and other Iraqis. The violence also included Al-Qaeda suicide bombings in Iraq, which angered many Iraqis. And there was international anger as the result of photos that showed American troops abusing Iraqi prisoners. President Bush had declared the end of major combat operations on May 1, 2003. That was less than 2 months after the invasion. But the numbers of civilian and military deaths were growing. And in the United States, surveys were showing that a growing number of Americans thought going into Iraq was a mistake.
The bad news was we were uncomfortable with it, and we wanted to get out, and we could not understand how things could go so terribly wrong.
Judith Yaffe joined the National Defense University after 20 years as a Middle East expert at the Central Intelligence Agency.
That's where the lack of strategy and the mismanagement come in. But I think it's also true that, you know, Americans just wanted to say, why are we in Iraq? Why are we in any of these places? Because historically speaking, it's not a role we've been comfortable with.
She says by President Bush's second term, few Iraqis wanted to cooperate with the Americans to make the country more secure. But President Bush said American troops could not leave until Iraqi forces replaced them. In 2006, an Iraqi court sentenced the country's former leader to death. Saddam Hussein was hanged for crimes against humanity. But nothing else seemed to change. Violence and insurgent attacks continued. Iraq seemed to be on the edge of being torn apart by civil war. Early the next year, President Bush announced that he was sending more troops to Iraq. He thought it would help stop the violence.
These troops will work alongside Iraqi units and be embedded in their formations. Our troops will have a well-defined mission to help Iraqis clear and secure neighborhoods, to help them protect the local population, and to help ensure that the Iraqi forces left behind are capable of providing the security that Baghdad needs.
The temporary increase of about 30,000 troops came to be called the surge. In September of 2007, the top commander in Iraq reported to Congress that the violence was decreasing. The surge may have helped create the conditions for this change, but there were other reasons as well. Middle East expert Judith Yaffe says many Iraqis decided to work with the Americans to defeat the insurgency.
The real truth is, and it's a good news story, that the Iraqis themselves saw that this was a greater danger to them, that there was nothing to be gained. The Sunnis of Iraq in particular saw that Al-Qaeda was hurting them, that it was a danger to them, that there was much more to be gained by aligning with the U.S. forces.
By the time President Bush was finishing his second term, Iraqi and American officials had agreed on a withdrawal date to end the war. The last American forces would leave Iraq by the end of 2011. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says it is too soon to know how history will judge the United States' actions in Iraq.
If Iraq proves to be a policy success, then the surge will be a critical turning point and a terrific exercise of presidential leadership.
He also points out that the war is not the only measure by which the 43rd president will be judged. Professor Riley put it this way: the great debate among historians will not be whether Bush was a powerful president or a consequential president, but whether he directed those powers in the most fruitful way that he could have. So what else was going on in the United States during this period? Millions of people were voting for which singer should get a recording contract on American Idol. Year after year, it was the most popular show on television.
Oh, Robert, I think you just killed my favorite song of all time.
Killed in a good way or a bad way?
I'm afraid. Well, listen, killing is never good.
Killing is never good.
There's never a happy killing.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I mean, that was first degree on that one.
I need some shelter, my own protection, baby.
But the biggest story in music was not what people were listening to, but how. Sales of CDs in stores fell as more and more people downloaded songs from the internet. On iTunes, Fergie's Big Girls Don't Cry was the most downloaded song of 2007.
And big girls don't cry.
For the first half of the decade, there seemed to be nothing to cry about in the American housing market. Home prices were going up and up, which made sellers happy. And lenders were offering bigger and bigger loans at easy terms and low interest rates, which made buyers happy. The government supported the easing of lending rules as a form of social policy, a way to help more people buy homes. Rates of home ownership, a part of the American dream, reached record highs. In 2005, nearly 7 out of 10 Americans owned their own home. But many home buyers had been given mortgage loans that they could not afford to pay back. And that was not the only problem. Banks had been selling those loans as securities to investors around the world. Everyone thought they were getting a good deal. The banks, the borrowers, the investors. But then the price bubble burst and the housing market collapsed. Many borrowers lost their homes because they were unable to make their monthly loan payments. That was the situation Karen Lucas and her husband of Cleveland, Ohio, found themselves in.
I've done my crying. I've made my peace, and I put it in God's hands.
As home values fell, many people found themselves underwater, meaning they owed more on their mortgage than their house was worth. Suddenly, there was a lot to cry about. By the end of 2007, the economy was sliding into the Great Recession.
And that's our show. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with another Learning English program on the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Katie Weaver.